Welcome to this podcast from the Carter Center.
Ayo manyare dumarga gonbiria gweya bina junuga dile warwa nime Ayo de galela kuma kuro de jangun magangle jodo ba kole de tangiye
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a guinea one.
Nyarfu.
People get guinea worm disease when they drink water from stagnant ponds that have been contaminated by other people who have entered the water supply.
Guinea worm is a debilitating disease. It's caused by a large worm growing inside a human body that penetrates the skin with a terrible sore.
These worms are about a meter long, 2 to 3 feet long.
That leaves a young child, for instance, with the same characteristics as polio, crippled for life. How many of you have ever had guinea worms? The people who suffer from guinea worm lived in the most remote, isolated, poorest communities in the world. It didn't seem to have any solution, and so it was almost an insurmountable problem. That's why we decided to try to solve it. We eventually visited 23,600 villages in 20 different countries. 3 countries in Asia, 17 countries across the sub-Saharan region of Africa.
The most important thing is that we need to make sure that the system is working, and we need to make a total overhaul.
Don't you people think that we all have a responsibility to the water we drink, to make sure that the water we drink is clean?
See that?
I understand that the children, maybe they don't listen.
Yeah, they don't listen.
But our job as parents is to teach our children.
We have eliminated 99.9%, and we're working on that last few hundred cases in just a few countries. This will be the second disease in the history of the world that's ever been completely eradicated from the face of the earth.
If you leave one worm, there's the potential for the entire thing to come back, to come back. I'm absolutely confident that guinea worm will be eradicated. The only question is how soon.
Good evening. I'm John Hardman, President and CEO of the Carter Center, and welcome you to the final program in this year's Conversations at the Carter Center. Tonight's program, Behind the Scenes, Foul Water, Fiery Serpent. We have a special donor audience here with us tonight, as well as people watching via webcast. Conversations is a series of discussions held at the Carter Center each year in which we discuss and share our work in the areas of peace and health and current world issues. Our conversation series is open to the public, but space is limited tonight, so members of the public have been invited to join us via the website. This webcast will be archived on the Carter Center website, and along with the other Carter Center conversations, can be accessed for later viewing. We are also covering this event tonight on our Twitter account using the hashtag ConvosTCC. Now, I'm told that a hashtag is a reference to a keyword that people use on Twitter to have a discussion. So we learn something new every day, and they will be part of the discussion. We will have a question and answer session as part of the program tonight, and at that time, we welcome you to go to one of the microphones on each side and tell us who you are and where you're from, and ask the question and join in the discussion with our panelists. The video trailer that you've just seen is an independent documentary on the campaign to eradicate guinea worm disease called Foul Water, Fiery Serpent. And tonight you will see never before seen footage and outtakes from the documentary. And we will learn about the triumphs and challenges that the Carter Center and its partners have faced over the last 25 years in our effort to wipe out the fiery serpent. We are pleased that tonight joining us, we have Molly Knight Raskin, who will moderate tonight's event. Molly is an award-winning journalist and freelance writer. She's a reporter. She's a producer who frequently covers health and medicine. And currently, she's a contributor for Lives, which is a global health edition of Scientific American. She has worked at the News Hour with Jim Lehrer, as well as for the Baltimore Sun. She received a Rosalind Carter Mental Health Journalism Fellowship in 2007 and wrote stories on borderline personality disorder, highlighting new treatment methods. She is joined by Dr. Ernesto Ruiz Tibben, who is the director of the Carter Center Guinea Worm Eradication Program. He joined the Carter Center in 1992 after more than 27 years of a distinguished career with the United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And since 1998, has served as the director of the Carter Center Guinea Worm Eradication Program. He works in conjunction with the World Health Organization and the CDC to monitor and disseminate information about the status of the global campaign and also to provide technical assistance to national eradication programs. Later this evening, as part of the program, we'll welcome two of Foul Water, Fiery Serpent's filmmakers to the panel. Gary Stryker, the film's director, and Ronald Borden, one of the videographers. Gary and Ron will share with you a special selection of behind-the-scenes footage they prepared for the event tonight. So please join me in welcoming Molly and Ernesto to the stage. And in addition, if you have forgotten to silence your pager or cell phone while you were out for the reception, please do that now. And now, Molly and Ernesto.
Well, it's an honor to be here tonight and share the stage with you. And
thank you very much.
We're going to just start off with some questions. I think everybody here would be interested to know that you just returned from Sudan. We saw a lot of footage from previous trips to Sudan earlier this evening when we screened the documentary, which gives everybody a little bit of an idea of some of the challenges you face when you're in the field in a place like that. Can you tell us a little bit about your trip? Maybe first you could just start off by sharing how long it took for you to get there.
It took 4 days to get out there, but I would like to first of all update you on the latest information on the status of guinea worm disease as of the end of 2010. There were only 1,797 cases reported in 2010 from four countries, plus one small outbreak in Chad, which was kind of unexpected. But 94% of those cases were reported from Sudan, 1,698 of those, 57 cases in Mali, 20 in Ethiopia, and only 8 in Ghana. And Ghana has reported 0 cases consecutively since May a year ago. So next month, at the end of May, if Ghana reports 0 cases, it will have been 1 full incubation period of this parasite, and Ghana will be then able to make the claim that they have also interrupted transmission and join the other 14 countries that have already eradicated. So it took me 4 days to get out from Atlanta to Europe, to Nairobi, to Juba, to Capoeira, and then to the eastern part of Equatoria State. The very beginning of the film, you see the landscape of eastern Equatoria. Sudan is a really, South Sudan alone is a really vast piece of land. You can fit easily with room to spare Ghana, Burkina Faso, Togo, and Benin, 4 West, formerly endemic countries in West Africa, in South Sudan, with room to spare. So it's really huge, and traveling in this place is difficult. There are no roads, there is no infrastructure, and on the one hand, on the other hand, it is very quiet and it's very peaceful, and you can see the whole of the Milky Way at night. So the purpose of the trip was just to follow up on the outcomes of the annual meeting that was hosted here at the Carter Center, where we reviewed the status of all the national eradication programs. And as you heard in the film, the program in South Sudan really got jump-started right after the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2005. And in December 2006, we sent our first resident technical advisor to Sudan to begin assisting there. And during 2006, we began to revitalize the program. So that program is 4 or 5 years old, compared to many other programs in the rest of the endemic countries that are more than 20 years old. And so we have had to literally jumpstart the program and learn as we go as best we can. And as you see from the film, Sudan is a very complex place with multiple tribes, multiple cultures, things that we have no understanding for in our side of the world. And it's difficult and very challenging. The purpose is really to make sure that that we begin in South Sudan to ratchet up the level and intensity and quality of surveillance required to detect every case of guinea worm before the worms come out. And the signs and symptoms that we're looking for is local itching or generalized itching on the body, which usually precedes the coming out of the worm, a swelling on the skin, particularly where it itches a lot, and the development of a blister in that site, and eventually the skin over the blister sloughs off, and you have the very characteristic coin lesion with a guinea worm protruding through it. So the key to being able to eradicate guinea worm in a place like Sudan is going to be hinging on early detection and early detection of cases and immediate response to each case to make sure that the patient is managed in such a way that he or she cannot contaminate water and is given the proper medical care in the process. So that's what I went out there to make sure is happening, and the outcome of that part was that it was in one area of eastern Equatoria has been done very well, but in another area that we visited, there were some flaws in the system that needed to be tightened up, and this kind of supervisory visits are very helpful to the program to detect those flaws and correct them. One of the things that we're doing in South Sudan now, we started a couple of years ago, is the use of what we call case containment centers. Case containment is really preventing a person from contaminating water. So if you do all the processes necessary and meet all the standards that are outlined to contain a case, then one can declare that that person has been prevented from transmitting his or her infection to others. And this case containment centers are ad hoc, literally primary healthcare units for guinea worm patients, because there's nothing out there. There's just no clinics, no medical health, no nothing, and no schools either. So we provide a modicum of care for all of the patients. They get fed 3 times a day instead of maybe once if they're in the village a day. And they have water, they can shower, and they have, we provide latrines and sanitation and medical care, and so they can heal faster, the worms are pulled out quicker. And if the patient self-reports, then to the case containment center before the worm comes out, then he or she gets a 50 kilogram, that's about 120 pounds, of sorghum grain, which is the basic staple in South Sudan. So people come in mangy, and they come thin and dirty, and they come out of the case containment center shiny and fatter, and with a sack of food that they can rely on. And this kind of incentive is it's paying great levels of dividend in the last year and this year. So we have now about 15 case containment centers in different parts of Sudan where there is a concentration of cases sufficient to warrant having a case containment center. And these are literally tents that we can pick up in a day and move to another place if we need to. So that's kind of the approach that we're using. In terms of challenges there, as you saw in the movie, all of these men that are here are real challenges to the program. I call them the testosterone group because they don't listen to anybody. They do what they want. They are the people who raid cattle, who carry around AK-47s, and often these cattle raid events turn deadly and also create a lot of insecurity. While I was there, we had an episode in a place called Boma, just north of where we were, where the Jia tribal group stole cattle from the Toposa tribal group, and then had the daring of driving the cattle to Boma town, which is controlled by another tribal group called the Merle. So the Merle, who are very renowned for their ferociousness, decided to confiscate the cattle from the Jia. So they did, and the Jia then retaliated and attacked the town with guns and spears and everything else and killed a number of people. Then the Merle retaliated against the Jia and burned 3 villages, Jia villages. All 3 of them were endemic with guinea worm disease, and so the people in those communities dispersed to the 4 winds. We don't know where they went. Eventually, they will repatriate to some central safe place, but we don't know where they are right now. And so we have a case containment center in this town, in Boma, with 18 GIA patients and 2 Carter Center Sudanese staff. And we had to evacuate the Sudanese staff and then leave the patients in charge of the Minister of Health and one other non-governmental group that's in that town working there. Just to give you an example of the kind of things that all of a sudden just develop and create operational or create havoc with our guinea worm operations in the context of Sudan. In 2008, we had at least 20 or more episodes of those kinds of transient insecurity periods in different places in South Sudan. So we're confronted with this all the time, and we give an give and take. We move out of the area, make sure all our staff are safe, and then move back in as soon as we can, and monitor where the people are fleeing to from one place to another. So that's a long spiel, but to answer your question.
You saved me some questions.
Sure.
To check a couple off right now. But actually, I think that, that raises a good point, which is that one of the challenges beyond logistical and beyond security is we saw in the film, you know, taking notes. Every last case has to be documented. Everybody who has symptoms, as Dr. Hopkins said, one case means guinea worm can come back. How do you, in a place like Sudan that's so vast and some of these other countries and so remote and people are scattering and there's conflict, and we see your volunteers walking from one village to another, how do you keep track? And what it must be a painstaking process to keep track of all of these people in these cases. Can you just tell us a little bit about record keeping and how important that is to the campaign and how you do it?
Well, it is very important. I mean, this has to be very well documented. Otherwise, the claim that you have eradicated the disease or interrupted transmission has no validity. But you know what is done is as follows. Guinea worm disease, like many other parasitic diseases, is focal in space and time. It's the occurrence of the disease is focal in space and time. So we know when and where transmission is occurring, and it's vital that we find out where transmission is occurring. Our job is to put, those are the big fires, so our job is to put those fires out so that the embers, people who may be traveling from here to there with guinea worm, eventually disappear. So we have in Sudan 227 villages that we know are endemic, meaning that there is transmission occurring in those villages. But we have 6,000 villages that we're monitoring daily for the possibility of cases. Just because people do travel and they get infected here, but travel and a year later, this 1 year incubation period provides a carrier state for the worm. And a year later, the patient may be elsewhere. Not where he got infected, but that's where he's detected. So our job then is to investigate the patient, do a travel history, and find out where he originated from and whether that place is known to be endemic or not. And this is the kind of dynamics that go on with the program on a day-to-day basis, all the time. And every time, if we miss one case, then as Don has said, you know, we're in business. As I like to say, a guinea worm anywhere is guinea worm everywhere.
We don't have much time left, so briefly, but I think this is an important question. The Guinea Worm Campaign, in many ways, is serving a model for another important eradication campaign for polio. What can we learn from, you know, guinea worm is a neglected disease in this country. Most people will never see it or know of it. What can we learn from this campaign, and how can we use it as an inspiration for eradication of another disease?
Well, I would say that, in my opinion, the polio eradication campaign and the guinea worm eradication campaign, although they share many of the same principles of eradication, are very different. Polio eradication is based on national immunization days and other mass immunization campaigns in more limited areas as needed, whereas this campaign is village-based, is one case at a time, in one village at a time, being handled by someone from the program at a time. And our job is 24/7, whereas with the polio campaign, you do this national immunization days during a period of 2 or 3 weeks, and you get it over and done with, and you come back next year. So that's why you saw in the movie the remark from David Stabilar, our current resident technical advisor in Sudan, saying if you want to, this is not polio work, this is guinea worm work, and we have to hunt the cases down.
Can you tell us just a little bit about what you enjoy the most about your work? We saw some painful cases. It's painful to see children who are suffering, anybody who's suffering from this. It's hard work. What do you enjoy the most about it?
Well, I do what I do because I have a lot of respect and I enjoy and working with the people I work with here at the Carter Center, and you know one can phrase it this in terms of passions. You have many passions, so that's one passion. The other passion is the faces of the people that we deal with in the field, particularly mothers and children. You know, in one case containment center in South Sudan that I visited, there were 35 women and children. And these are the very people who are, at this time of the year, should be in their farm areas weeding or planting the sorghum for next year. And they were all in the case containment center and jumping at the bed because they didn't want to be there. They wanted to be there. They wanted to be in the fields planting their food for next year. And nowhere else you could see one single man out in the field. The women do all the work. The men sit under the tree and play dominoes or do nothing else. But that's the culture. That's the culture there. And so that's another passion. Another passion, I would say, is the responsibility we feel to account to you, sitting out here in the audience, for the work we do, and the good use of the donor funding, and support that we receive, and it's our job to do that.
It sounds like you and your colleagues in this eradication campaign are a very close-knit group, and we saw that also in the movie as well, and a lot of you have been working on this for a long, long time. What keeps you going? Why are you so passionate about this disease? And I guess also, can you just tell me a little bit about some of the people you're working with on a daily basis?
Well, As you heard in the introduction, I worked at CDC for many, many years. I came to Atlanta in 1980 as part of the reorganization that CDC was mandated to do. And it was around that time that I met Don Hopkins here, who had already, together with Dr. William Feige of the CDC as well, had suggested that guinea worm should be the next disease to be eradicated. If you may recall, 1980 was the year when smallpox was the world was declared free of smallpox, and so the next disease to be engaged as an eradication effort was as Don and Bill Feige suggested was guinea worm disease, and the UN system had declared the period 1880-1990 the first drinking water and sanitation decade, and this disease is only transmitted via drinking water. So by rights, if that initiative was to be successful, the guinea worm would be gone from the world. But it didn't happen, and that's why the Carter Center got involved in 1986, because we saw that that would not happen, and we were very keen on making sure that guinea worm eradication was undertaken. So President Carter lent his voice and the offices of the Carter Center to make that happen. And we've been going at it since then. So, you know, our group in health, Don is our leader and is a person for whom we have a lot of admiration and respect. And the same for the other people who are part of the health Carter Center Health Team.
What do you think the legacy will be of the guinea worm campaign?
Well, the legacy is, and this will accrue forever, is that people, the most destitute people in the world, the poorest of the poor, will not have to suffer from guinea worm ever again. And we will not have to spend one more nickel on the eradication of guinea worm disease. We'll go on to tackle other diseases. And the world will be a lot better for having us done this job.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. And now I'm going to introduce Gary Stryker and also Ron Borden. They're the two filmmakers. You saw the film, the documentary screening earlier. Why not?
Stay around.
Gary.
So I think we're going to start out by seeing one of those behind-the-scenes video clips that we talked about earlier.
Should be some sound on this. This shows you.
Tell us a little bit about.
This shows you the kind of terrain that the technical advisors and others have to traverse to get to some of the villages. Shortly after the rains begin, all the roads turn to something like this. It's one of the things that's always impressed me about Africa, that no matter where you are, in the middle of nowhere, if you get stuck in the mud, people materialize out of the bush and help push you out of the mud. It's a phenomenon. But when you're in the car driving, you have music like this. The driver provides this for you, and you have no choice in the selection of the music. But you can endure this, the same tape over and over and over for about 7 or 8 hours. And when you have a rainstorm, the rivers flood very quickly, and we were stopped at this point for a few hours waiting for the river to subside because we had to drive.
We spent about 3 hours.
Yeah. We waited for somebody else to come by and try it before we decided to do it, and a truck finally came, and we held our breath as he went across the river, and then we decided, okay, well, we should try it. We had no idea how deep it was out there. But that happens frequently on any trip during the day. Now, this. We actually have some of this in the movie. This was less than 45 minutes outside the capital. And we still had like 8 hours or 9 hours to go. And within 20 minutes, we got stuck in the mud in this thing. And fortunately, because they were building the road, this bulldozer was there and was able to pull us out. And that shows also the privilege of being the director of the film. I stayed in the car and suggested to Ron, hey, Ron, why don't you go out and shoot this? So, he had to get out of the car and wade up to his chest, I think, in order to film this. And all the stuff in the back of the car got completely soaked, of course, so, including the sound technician. So. Ron has an interesting story about our first plane trip.
What, in the caravan or the commercial flight from... Nairobi.
Oh, this is the caravan.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the pilot turns back towards us. Ernesto, you're on the flight.
Yeah.
And he asks if anyone wants to say a prayer before we take off.
That's right.
Kind of encouraging. But my very first flight out of Nairobi, we had an aborted takeoff. Yeah. You know, that was the start of our trip.
Then that pilot asked us if he wouldn't mind if he kept the door open while he taxied for takeoff, which he did.
Yeah, it was pretty hot inside the plane. And you saw in the film quite a bit of material from the cattle camp. which was nearby, but cattle on the road on the airstrip had to be cleared out. You don't want to run into a herd of cattle on the landing strip. It's always a problem.
We took off from, I forget the name of the village, but it was very, the strip was very, very muddy, and the pilot literally had to walk the length of the strip to make sure that the wheels wouldn't bog down and we could take off. So.
And I don't know if you saw the, I guess maybe that clip dropped out, but you were shooting through the window as we were taking off, and on the side of the runway was a plane wreck. Mm-hmm. This is often the case in African landing strips. You see the wrecks of previous attempts on the side of the strip, and it's a bit disconcerting.
Well, thanks for sharing that. I think actually that's a good segue into a couple of questions about shooting this film. I'm sure that could be a story within this story. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the challenges shooting some of this material, particularly since you were focusing on a sometimes very graphic and gruesome disease? And as I think we've talked about, you saw some very upsetting cases. How did you handle shooting that?
I should say, first of all, that what you saw in the film is but a fraction of the guinea worm cases that we actually filmed. We had an initial rough cut of the film, which we showed to a private screening here at the Carter Center and at other screenings we had, test screenings, and the universal response that we had back from the audience was, oh, you just went, that's too much, I can't watch it. You know, I won't be able to eat spaghetti for another year. You know? And it was a decision that was hard for us because we sent one cameraman to Ghana for 10 days, and his sole mission was to get close-ups of guinea worms being extracted from people's wounds. And I think I used one of those shots in the final analysis because it was just too much. But Ron can probably tell a little more experience.
Well, shooting those scenes, for me, I guess there's a little industry secret. Our viewfinders are black and white, so you're sort of detached from the reality of what's happening around you, so it helps you, you know, focus on your job at hand. You know, we have to get the shots, you know, no matter, you know, it's really hard to hear the screams of the little four-year-old girl as we're extracting the guinea worm, but, you know, you just, you have to do your job. You have to make sure you just sort of get into that documentarian mode where you know you have to get certain coverage, you know, you have to have sound, you know, you have to be in focus. And, but having the viewfinder, a monochromatic image, and it's a very small 3x4-inch, you know, screen in my viewfinder. It really helps separate you from what's happening, so you can do it. But it's—I told you this, Gary. It's hard for me to see it again in color on the big screen. It really is very, you know, traumatic.
Yeah, that was a trick I learned in working for CNN when I was shooting my own material during the wars that we covered, when people were, or the famines as well, when people were dying in front of the camera or people were suffering or being shot. When you're one dimension removed from everything that's going on in front of you and it's black and white and you're looking through the lens, that's a trick you can use to divorce yourself from what's actually happening around you. And it's much more difficult later on to actually watch the stuff that you shot in color, and that it's a lot more powerful.
What about safety concerns? Did you have any when you were shooting in Sudan? I mean, you've got a big, giant camera with you, and did you face any challenges with that? People saying they didn't want to be filmed or anything like that?
Not really. In the cities, you know, you would get a little bit of that in Juba. But out in the villages, no, they're very welcoming. And it was curious because you would think that there would be some sort of reaction to this. I mean, it's a very big camera on someone's shoulder, but I think they were just happy that we were there. We cared about their situation, and it wasn't really a big issue. I think from a security standpoint, we talked about this a little bit, I was more concerned about those kids with the 14-year-olds with the AK-47s guarding
right.
the cattle.
And, well, tell everybody a little bit about that.
Because of the cattle raids, you know, cattle is, you know, like basically a form of currency for them, and it's a very serious problem. And you've got literally kids who are armed, and their mission is to protect their herds. It's a little disconcerting.
Do you think it was maybe the first time some of those people had ever seen a big video camera?
Good question.
Possibly, but unlikely, I think. I mean, there have been people there with cameras, you know, in and out. We used to joke about during the famines in Ethiopia and Somalia, where we would go into the camps and we would be shooting, and kids would come up to us and be talking to us in their local language, and nobody knew what they were saying. And that, you know, we would translate it. He's asking us, "Is that a Panasonic 4539? That's a Sony. That's a wide-angle lens, isn't it?" You know, I mean, these kids, you know, were pretty used to seeing cameras. And stuff. But in Sudan, it's. You know, I still say, you know, in southern Sudan, if you really want to see Africa, raw Africa, the way it has been for centuries, southern Sudan is a place that can't be beat, because it is where the outside world has had tremendously little effect, you know, for the last five decades. And a funny incident happened when Ron first went there with me. Ron had been in Africa before. He had shot a few jobs in Africa, but he'd never been to southern Sudan. So this was total immersion for him. And our first day, we got out of the car, and I'm not sure what they were doing. They were drinking unfiltered water, or they were taking filters and distributing them. Something was going on, but there were a lot of people there. And I just told Ron, I said, let's shoot this, you know, build a sequence on this thing. And 90% of the people there had no clothes on whatsoever, right? Possibly a small apron or something. And Ron picks up the camera, starts to shoot, and he looks at me and says, "What do I do about this?" And I said, "Just shoot it, Ron. You're not going to get away. There's no way you're going to be able to get around this, you right?" Know? So
that was the Tuposa tribe.
That was the Tuposa, yeah.
And it was time has not touched them. I mean, it was very like stepping back in time. Yeah. It was amazing.
And I think Ron should also speak to the opening sequence in the film, where you actually see Ernesto pull the worm, hold the worm up after McCoy has pulled it out of the little girl who's screaming her head off. But Ron should talk about this, because this was the first time we had actually seen a worm fully extracted. You don't see that too often. And we had expected that they would pull it out an inch or so and then bandage it up again and we would move on. And this thing kept coming and coming and coming, and Ron shot this, but I think he should relate what happened.
Well, it was about a 20-minute process, and our tapes are only about 30 minutes long. So we're shooting, and concentrating on getting the shots that we need. And as we get down, I was sort of caught by surprise that the worm came out. And as we were getting to that point, I have this indicator in my camera that, you know, lets me know. It doesn't tell me how much tape I have left, but it lets me know that the red light starts blinking and you're in trouble. So we're shooting around. McCoy hands Ernesto the worm. Ernesto holds the worm up, and we get that great soundbite and the great shot. You know, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is a guinea worm." And literally 10 seconds later, the tape stopped. We ran out of tape, so we're that close to losing that moment.
That's not the way it usually happens, okay? Somebody was watching over you, I think, at that point.
Yeah. So. Was there anything, both of you have done a lot of traveling all over the world and have been in Africa before, what surprised you the most about being in Sudan and this trip and traveling with the Guinea Worm Program?
For me, I guess, well, the heat was just indescribable, and you have to work in this heat, so that was something to definitely get used to. I've shot in Saudi Arabia before, and for some reason, this was worse.
You grew up in Georgia,
yeah, but
South Carolina, right?
But we have trees and shade. And just surprised the vastness of the country, just really amazed at the Carter Center and just tackling such a logistical, it's indescribable until you see what they really have to deal with. For us, travel in the cars in the back with all our gear, we're traveling 6 hours to get to a village. And it's rough. The roads are very, very rough. And this is in the dry season. You know, the Carter Center has to supply their people throughout the year, rain or not. And it's just amazing that they're able to do it, and very efficiently. It's an incredible operation.
I think we're going to see this next clip here, which will be kind of fun to talk about, which is the cattle camp.
Mm. Yeah, this is the essence of Southern Sudan, the cattle camps. Yeah. We just happened to cross this event that was going on. There was actually a wedding happening in one of these camps. And people had been celebrating for several days, and they were pretty well juiced up. And they exulted in our being there and taking pictures.
These are the Dinka people.
These are Dinkas, yeah. And they get into quite elaborate skin and hair stylings, and it's not blood, but it is paint. But there are literally hundreds of people, thousands of cows, a lot going on in a place like this. And as I said, it makes it very difficult for the guinea worm campaign because people are coming and going and moving all over the place. And this dance was somehow, was just extemporaneous. And that preceded the wrestling match that you saw. When you're shooting television like this, when this something like this happens, this is, yes, there is a God. I mean, you have to really appreciate it to be in the right place at the right time for something like this to happen, because usually you arrive, oh, you should have been here yesterday. We had a cattle camp, we had wrestling, We hit it right several times in these camps, so we were fortunate.
The cattle camps is sort of a 4D experience. So you've got sights, sounds, smells, and then just the space.
Now this shot tells you exactly what Ron was thinking. Am I seeing what I think I'm seeing? And of course, it's a common thing. Dyeing the hair with cow urine is important because they drink cow blood as well, and cattle are very important to their culture.
What did he do with it? He left it in the cattle, so he can't even hold on to it for 10 minutes.
Now, Stefan was inquiring what happened to this guy's water filter, his pipe filter, because he didn't have it. And he said, oh, he put it in his hut. He said, how come he doesn't have it? So the guy turns around and grabs one from one of the kids. And Stefan says, well, that's great. He doesn't have his, so he takes it from the kid. Can you ask him to give it back to the kid? And go?
What did he do with the one that we gave?
Well, funny little moments like this happen all the time when the TAs are out there doing their job.
Tell him to give the pipe filter back to the child.
It's quite an experience in a cattle camp. The dancing will go on and the singing will go on all night. Some of them might crash and sleep after sunrise for a little while, but then it all starts all over again.
I'm such a poor man. All right.
But visually, it's an exhilarating experience to film in a place like that.
I feel like I really shouldn't take credit. I mean, because every way you turn is an incredible, incredible shot. There was a moment in the film in the cattle camp where we were walking out, and I was leading Stefan. I was walking backwards, and Stefan was talking about something relatively serious. And there was a lot of laughter going around from the people around Stefan. They were laughing at me because I just stepped in several cow patties, and they thought that was all very, very funny.
I think they were also admiring your shoes. You had some rather elaborate track shoes, and they thought it was very funny that you were stepping into that stuff with those shoes. Yeah. But, you know, I want to say that one of the things that we're trying to do with our films is to produce a kind of a new genre of global health film, which really hasn't been done before. We're trying to pump up the production values with the music and the graphics, the animation, the special effects, and everything that will make a film more compelling and more engaging and entertaining for the viewers, and they can still learn something at the same time. We're building public awareness. And we're doing it, I mean, we don't have, in our films, you'll never find them, we don't have runway models or rock stars. Well, unless you consider President Carter, like many of us would, a rock star. But we don't have runway models, let's put it that way. You know what I mean, but we're not gonna use that as a gimmick to try to get these points across. There's something to be said for that because it does engage a wide audience if you have a celebrity attached. But we believe that the celebrities in our films are the people who are in the field doing this kind of work, the people who have the passion for it. And I think that we have engaging characters, people who deserve some respect and recognition for what they're doing. All the way from people like Ernesto to the local village volunteers. And that's the thing that impressed me most. I lived in Africa for 29 years and spent a lot of time covering disasters, humanitarian campaigns, relief campaigns and the like. And usually, you've got a bunch of expatriates driving around in Land Cruisers and getting paid very well, living pretty comfortable lives, doing good work by and large, but in many cases not very good work and not very hard work either. And that's the thing that really impressed me when I got into this Guinea Worm campaign, in both in Ghana and in Sudan. We spent nearly 4 years shooting this, and spent a lot of time in the field following them around, really schlepping, really walking long distances, and it was much worse for the cameraman who's carrying a 40-pound camera to have to trudge along and follow these guys. But they spend a lot of time on foot, going from one village to another, living in tents, working one-on-one with community volunteers who carry a large part of the work, too. You don't see that in many health campaigns. You haven't. And I hope that one of the, like we were talking about the legacy of the Guinea Worm campaign, I hope that one of the legacies will be more community-based health campaigns like this, because I think that's what makes the difference between successful campaigns and those that are not. Because when the Guinea Worm parasite is eradicated, there will remain, as part of the legacy of this Guinea Worm campaign, a structure and an ethic and a pattern of conduct and that I think can continue for, in respect of other diseases. That will be something that people in villages will have familiarity with, and they'll expect that kind of process to continue to improve their general health as time goes on. If we did it with the Guinea Worm campaign, why can't we do this with schistosomiasis? Why can't we do it with river blindness? Why can't we do it with all these other diseases that they face on a day-to-day basis? But that's what impressed me with the Guinea Worm campaign, especially.
Can you just tell us a little bit about the film, what your plans for it are? Where are you showing it? What's the reception been so far?
The film has not been released for general distribution yet. We're screening it at special events like this. It has screened in 9 or 10 graduate schools in the country so far, at Harvard, University of Washington, Berkeley, and others, Ohio University, I think in 2 weeks, Thomas Jefferson University. We're presenting it to graduate students in public health who are interested in careers in global health. And it's making an impression with them because they can see exactly what kind of challenges people face doing this kind of work on the front lines. We have won several film festival awards With the film, the LA Reel Film Festival, we got best concept, best documentary, best director, best music, best narration, and we've also won best environmental film here at the Atlanta Docs International Festival, and that was, you know, it was good for us. But we're talking to various broadcast networks now. We want to get it on television nationally and international distribution as well. So that's basically where we are.
Could you just, we're going to open it up for questions from the audience shortly. But I think just since you've been covering it for so long, and of course, Dr. Rustaban, you've been working in this campaign for 2 decades, could you just tell us a little bit about one moment in particular, maybe from shooting or from your work, that sticks out in particular in your mind that makes you passionate about getting out the message about Guinea Worm, making this film, and working this campaign? And I guess maybe all of you could answer that.
Okay. Well, for me, there are many moments that I could talk about. I'm always very impressed about the generosity of the very people that you see in the film. On many, many occasions, we have been visiting at the villages, talking to the residents about guinea worm disease and how they can prevent it, et cetera, et cetera. And at the end of our visit, they present us with untold amounts of yams or chickens, perhaps their most valued possessions, because they don't have very much. And that's always very touching. Our drivers usually are the ones who enjoy these gifts, but the generosity of the people there. The other thing that has impressed me always, and it's particularly poignant in South Sudan, is how stoic and how strong the women are, and how much they put up with from this men that they live with. But it's really very, very, very impressive. And and they are the ones who usually connect with our messages first, and they become our voices at the village level. But even then, have a lot of trouble translating these messages about preventing guinea worm disease to the males in their society. And that's the sticking point. Fortunately, in South Sudan, transmission of guinea worm disease occurs near the villages where they do their farming, or at the village site itself. And it's mostly women and children who are involved. And the men are around to do heavy work at times, and that's where they get infected. The idea of people, a lot of people getting infected in cattle camps is just not well documented in South Sudan, so we're continuing to focus on where we believe transmission is occurring. But those are some of the things that I would say.
Are you, Gary?
I think the thing that really impressed me on during the production of this film was actually initiated when President Carter visited Ghana in February 07, when we started shooting most of the principal photography of this film. What had happened in Ghana, which is not reflected in the 40-minute cut of the film, was that the water supply system for the city of Tamale, which is in the north of Uganda, had broken down. So the town, fairly large town, small city actually, was getting its water from the Volta River about 30 miles away. And when the pumps broke down, there was no water coming into the city. So people relied exclusively for their water on these water cellars that you saw with their big 50-gallon drums. Or they went to the local stagnating ponds and got their water from there. And that's when there was a huge outbreak of guinea worm in the Tamale region. And Ghana's guinea worm cases had been going down for years before that, before 2006, and then all of a sudden they started shooting up again. And it looked really, really grim. Like, and this was just before the Africa Games were going to be held in Ghana, and they had a big stadium in Tamale, and they were going to have people from all over Africa attending these games in the city of Tamale, and the possibility of all these people from Africa drinking this water contaminated with guinea worm and then going back to their countries, spreading it throughout the continent, was just too horrible to think about. So President Carter arrived, and I had never seen him like this. He was determined to chastise the Ghanaian government for failing to address this problem and allowing the guinea worm campaign to suffer that kind of reversal. And we attended quite a few meetings between President Carter and the Ghanaian government. And he was very stern, very commanding in his tone. And in fact, halfway in jest, he said he had threatened to change the name of the parasite to Ghana worm if the government didn't change its attitude. And they did respond, to their credit. But from the highest level, the word went down that they had to do something about this. And when we came back a year later, they had indeed reversed it. And it from then on, it's been descending, you know, declining cases all the way. But there was a good example of the kind of power that the Carter Center can bring to a campaign, especially with President Carter intervening personally. But you know, his word, his personality carries a lot of weight. And that was really impressive. And I thought, boy, if we could only bring that kind of pressure to bear in other countries on other issues, you know, Africa would fare a lot better economically, politically, socially, in many ways, if they could respond to that kind of pressure from time to time.
And I was most impressed and remain very impressed by the commitment of the TAs, the young people that are working on the ground. And it's just, I mean, I know how hard it was for me physically to work in Africa, the hardships, the heat, lack of sleep, lack of food, good food, not enough food. So, you know, these young people are, I mean, it's just incredible. They were wading through ponds that I, you know, would not step in to take measurements, you know, so they could do their abate. Just incredible commitment. And I think that was the most impressive for me.
What's next in terms of your filming? Any projects you want to share with us?
Well, you saw the trailer for the River Blindness film. We're doing the rough cut for that. Should have that done by the end of this month. But by late summer, we expect to release that film, Dark Forest, Black Fly, about the River Blindness campaign in Uganda. And we have another one, which we've almost finished shooting, in Ethiopia on trachoma and malaria. And that's been a hugely successful campaign to distribute mosquito nets, build latrines, and distribute antibiotics for the treatment of trachoma. And a campaign that could be, you know, copied. It could be a model for others in Africa, because the government has really made this a high priority, with a major role played by the Carter Center and the Lions Club International in the campaign.
And can you just tell us a little bit, we saw the trailer, about the River Blindness campaign, and just anything from shooting that?
Ron has done some of that.
Oh, just behind the scenes or anecdotally?
Anecdotally.
Well, there's one incident. We're shooting in a river. It was in the rainforest, and we're in this river. It was raining on us. Dr. Frank Richards was there with us, and we were looking for crabs with the larvae on them. And I was shooting, and apparently there are these black ants that will crawl up your legs, and simultaneously they somehow send a signal and they bite you at the same time. And this happened to me while we were shooting that. Remember that?
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
it was quite painful. And as I was shooting, I was disrobing, trying to figure out what was going on.
Did you get the shot?
We got the shot. We got the shot.
Little camera shake there.
Just a bit.
But,
Yeah, it's a very interesting story because river blindness in the Americas is probably going to be eliminated by 2015, with any luck. In Africa, in most of Africa, it's all about controlling the disease with these Mectazan tablets that are provided free by the Merck company. It's the same medicine you give your dog for heartworm, basically, and they discovered that it can kill the larvae, microfilaria in the body, and eliminate, you know, river blindness, provided you haven't been blinded already, then in which case there's no reversal. But Uganda has made a commitment to eliminate the disease completely and just eliminate the parasite once and for all. In the rest of Africa, it's more about controlling it. So we've been following the campaign in Uganda for 3 years to show how they're actually accomplishing this or plan to accomplish it. And it's another, like guinea worm, it's something that you can only shoot at certain times of the year, and you've got to follow them over a course of time, and it takes years to put these kinds of stories together, but it's been extremely interesting.
Great. I know you're all burning to ask some questions, so we're going to open it up for questions and answers now. And if you could just state your name and where you're from before you ask the question.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Hampton from St. Louis, Missouri. And as I've been watching the film and thinking about our bottled water here, I was wondering, what did you drink? And did you worry about parasites? And did you treat any water or drinking, whatever you drank when you were traveling?
We buy bottled water. And that's something we carry on the vehicles, and that's what we drink. And we also have our pie filters and cloth filters, so if we need to drink some water from stagnant sources, at least we're not going to get guinea worm. We may get diarrhea, but not guinea worm.
But as irrational as it might seem, after my last trip, I'd always count 12 months and make sure, make sure there's nothing emerging from my leg. Even though I knew we were safe because we drank bottled water, but it was still that fear.
I'm Polly Stambridge from California. Dr. Ruiz Tabban, I've seen you for many years, and for some reason you haven't aged. I can't imagine why. Here's my question. When you extract a worm from the patient, does that mean that they no longer have any larvae or other worms in them? They are okay?
If that's the only worm the patient has, yes, that's okay. The worms live 1 year.
Oh.
And then they come out or they're pulled out, and that's the end of that worm.
And if you are...
But the patients can have multiple infections acquired the year before, so you can have a person having worms coming out sequentially over a period of weeks or months, and so each worm has to be handled, manually extracted.
And if you weren't there and they went into the water and the larva got extracted, would the worm just stay in the body? And
the worm has no means of emerging by itself outside the body. It has to be pulled out.
Oh.
Rolled up in a little stick.
And the natives would do that themselves.
Well, that's a traditional way. Everywhere where guinea worm occurs, people know how to handle it.
Good question.
Egyptian mummies have been found with guinea worms inside them, by the way.
The symbol of medicine has the snake wrapped around it, the caduceus. It's a snake. It's supposed to be a snake, but it's really a guinea worm. That's the traditional method of rolling up the guinea worms from ancient times.
In your experience, how many guinea worms have been found in one individual?
The record, as I know it, is in Nigeria. I think we had one patient with 66 worms coming out in a single year. One or two worms every week.
And you talked about this in the film, but you can be symptom-free and still have the worm in you until a certain
point.
For
one whole year, you are without symptoms but infected.
Bill Chapman, Baltimore, Maryland. The water question again. I always wonder this. It's probably show my ignorance about geology, but how come there are not wells drilled where people can drink good water? I mean, it's probably a stupid question, but.
No question is stupid if it needs an answer. We could talk about water all night long. The water sector organizations in these countries, including in South Sudan, are in the business of providing water. What we do in every Guinea worm eradication program is that we make the data about villages with endemic Guinea worm disease known to the water sector organizations, and we advocate, the program advocates with the water sector organizations for targeting villages with Guinea worm disease with a higher level of priority than all other villages that also need water, just because this disease is only transmitted via drinking water. So the water sector organizations every year promise a number of boreholes that they're going to drill here and there, and they invariably what happens is only some of those wind up in Guinea worm endemic villages. In some cases, politicians divert some of these boreholes to their own villages or for other reasons, things like that. So the water sector has never been able to catch up with the needs of the Guinea worm eradication program. I can tell you that in all of the countries where transmission of Guinea worm has been interrupted, not a single one of them have the last villages, last endemic villages in those countries been covered completely with safe water. So it's just a state of affairs that we have to deal with. But we continue to advocate with UNICEF and with other organizations that are in the business of providing water to do so and help us accelerate the pace of the eradication effort.
Can you say a name?
Sue Duchemois from Charlotte, North Carolina. And first, let me say thank you for your work. This is fantastic. Every year I come, and every year it's, you know, you've reduced the infection more and more every year. But when you talk about 66 worms, what is the residual effect on the health of a person who has that many infections?
Well, I don't know how best to answer your question. As far as I know, even if you have a single worm, you recover from it quickly, and there doesn't seem to be any residual. People who like this person in Nigeria with 66 worms, what you invariably find is that this guy is perhaps not completely sane, or is a town drunk, or there's something aberrant with this kind of people who, for some reason, have a higher propensity of becoming infected repeatedly in their own villages and their own settings, and not now in this day and age, but a few years back, 10 years back or so, you could, in any one of these countries, you could go to one of these villages and you find one such person like that. But they seem to recover, as far as I know, well from this.
So we haven't extracted then. You don't have any long-term health effects from.
Well, you can have long-term effects if, for example, one of those worms happens to be wrapped around a joint and it dies there and begins to putrefy, and it then does damage to the joint, and you can have an ankylosed leg or an ankle, and then you become paralyzed or crippled for life as a result of that. Not unlike polio.
Just actually to follow up on that question, is there any stigma to having guinea worm if you're in a village where, and you're a woman of marrying age perhaps, and you have several, or is it just?
Under normal circumstances, there is no stigma, but often the people in the guinea worm eradication program themselves are too aggressive, and over time, there are some in the community who may have guinea worm who tend to hide from the people in the program because they it is the program itself that creates the stigma mm-hmm. for having that, and it all has to do with how careful or uncareful you are about relating to the community in a way that's constructive rather than unconstructive.
We have a question over here.
This has probably been answered before, but I just don't recall the answer. Why aren't other mammals or other animals impacted by this? Why just humans?
Well, Dracunculus medinensis is a parasite that's highly adapted to humans and only to humans, as far as I know. Experimentally, you can get some monkeys infected and perhaps even some strains of dogs infected with this parasite, but this is in the laboratory circumstance. In nature, it's only humans. But I can tell you, as I was telling someone earlier tonight, in this country and in Canada, there is a strain of Dracunculus, a species of Dracunculus called Dracunculus insignis rather than medinensis, which is a parasite of the raccoons, the otters, the martens, and other fur-bearing animals associated with water. And the presentation in those animals is exactly the same. However, the life cycle is slightly different. There is a what we call a transport host or a paratenic host that has to be involved. So instead of the raccoons becoming infected by drinking water, they get infected by eating fish or tadpoles or other animals who themselves have eaten the copepods with the larvae, and the larvae have survived in their tissue. So it's not through drinking water, it's by predating on some other organism.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Carolyn Owentoll, San Diego, California. I wonder if you can tell us what has been the cost of this program so far, and where the main sources of the funds have come from, and what do you project for the rest of the process that you hope will be completed?
We have spent about $250 million in this campaign so far. We think we're going to need about $61 million additional dollars to finish the job by 2015. Our goal is to stop transmission in 2012 and begin to report zero cases from all the remaining countries about 2013 and have the world declare free of guinea worm disease by 2015. That's what we're aiming for. Whether that happens or not, I cannot guarantee you, but we're going to do our darnest to get there.
And the sources of the money?
Well, here and the other foundations, bilateral donors, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been a major donor of the Carter Center for guinea worm eradication, among others.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll take another on this side, and then maybe we'll get someone over here. Go ahead.
John Fulton Ford, Texas. In the movie, there was a gentleman that was questioning his faith because he had got guinea worm. And I just wondered, it looks to me from the numbers that the Carter Center's, the decreasing numbers of cases, that it is going to be eradicated. And I just wondered if any of you three had plans on going back to see that gentleman and letting him know that no, and kind of being the answer to his prayer. That's pretty cool. I just wondered if any of you three were going to do that.
Well, I don't know exactly which village this was at, but we'll keep that in mind. Well,
it would make a great film.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
My name's Taylor Layton. I'm from Evanston, Illinois. My question is about differing cultures. You mentioned that there were up to 6,000 villages monitored at a time, and I think in the movie or one of you said that there were like three different tribes in a very nearby area. What methods or what do you, especially for like the tech assistants or whatever their names are, what do you tell them to expect when they walk into a random village, or and how do you think it's best maneuvering between their different customs and their differing cultural beliefs?
You mean what do we tell our technical advisors?
Or anything in your experience, but I guess both sides of it would be interesting to me, but whatever you feel like you can elaborate on more fully.
Well, the endemic areas are known, and we know ahead of time which tribal groups occupy those areas, or whether there are multiple groups there. So the program staff takes the time to brief our technical advisors on the situation in these areas, and when they go there, there's already a local team working with these groups and making things happen.
Is there much diversity of treatment between the tribes, or of like differing ways to approach the issue?
Well, traditional methods for treating guinea worm disease at the local level are there is a whole range of techniques that they use traditionally. Ours is simply managing the patient, keeping the wounds clean and free of secondary bacterial infections. It is the secondary bacterial infections that exacerbate the inflammation and the pain that's associated with these worms. And once that wound gets infected, and probably all along the tract where the worm is gets infected, then you have a problem. So keeping the wound clean with antiseptics, applying topical antibiotics, keeping the wounds bandaged until gradually the whole worm is pulled out is the technique that we use. At the local level, they may go see a local healer, and then he may apply a cow dung or other God knows what kind of poultice on it. Some people, they use hot pokers, and they burn a hole right through the lesion and burn everything. And they do this even in children. Which is a practice that's abhorrent to us, and we try to, you know, stamp out if we can in those settings. That was very common in Nigeria, for example, just to give you a range. In some places, they use scorpions to bite the worm, sting the worm. I mean,
makes sense.
Yep. Thanks.
You're welcome.
I think that's a great question because it builds on what we were talking about before, but the challenge is not only logistical, not only tracking down every case, but also each village, maybe the personality of a village chief, maybe a witch doctor who's popular in that particular area, and
exactly.
Having to get past that as well. Can I go ahead?
Hi, Brad Dyke from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Obviously, it takes a certain degree of art to recruit donors to help eradicate some of these neglected diseases, but it's got to be 10 times easier to recruit donors than to recruit field workers. How do you recruit your field workers?
Well, if we're talking about technical advisors, expatriate technical advisors, our focus of attention are the schools of public health, staff at CDC. The word gets around. These TAs have recruited themselves, the next generation of TAs, which are now in Sudan. We have about 25 of them in Sudan, and they know each other, so it's a network of interactions. And the work of the Carter Center itself gets advertised and disseminated to the four winds, so a lot of people know and a lot of people have interest, and they contact us about it, and we review their CVs and decide on which ones we think may qualify and to do the kind of work. Not everybody's got out to work in the context of Sudan or can last out there for a long period of time.
It seems to me like so they're the amazing ones.
Yeah, we've had our share of burnouts and other flops with some of our technical advisors, but that's part and parcel of the game.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think we have time for about one more question.
Yeah, most of those TAs are certainly ex-Peace Corps volunteers or people who've been in Africa and have African experience and can hack it out in those settings.
Go ahead.
I'm John Montgomery from Houston, Texas. If the guinea worm is the second disease to be eradicated, what are the next three, and what kind of time frames do you see for them?
Well, I'm very confident the guinea worm is going to be eradicated. The question for us, as Don said in the film, is exactly when that's going to happen, but we're going to be shooting for 2015. The polio eradication is underway as well, and they should be, hopefully, will be able to finish on par with us or even before us or maybe slightly after us. The important thing is not whether who's going to get there first. The important thing, and the real critical thing, is that all diseases slated for eradication are eradicated. That's the key thing, because we cannot afford one of these eradication programs, the ultimate public health weapon, to fail. But next in line may be missiles. Missiles is being eliminated, or pre-eliminated, as they call, and we have onchocerciasis in the process of, or river blindness is in the process of being eliminated from the Americas. So that's a regional eradication program, and there's a lot of effort to apply the lessons learned in this side of the world to apply to the endemic areas of Africa and also interrupt transmission of onchocerciasis in Africa eventually. That's going to take a number of years from now, but it's likely to happen.
Great. I see you've been waiting. We've got about 30 seconds. Is it a quick one?
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. I just wanted to ask, how do you know when it is eradicated? Because if you say, we've eradicated it, and the gestation period is a year, there could be somebody somewhere that's carrying the worm that's not going to come out until later, and that could start. Is there a local level that, if they find out that it's in a village, that goes in and takes care of that?
No, the answer is surveillance, surveillance, surveillance. We stay in place for at least 10 to 14 months beyond the last known indigenous case. So if the surveillance system in the country is appropriate and adequate and sensitive, and then we're going to find out if a person has guinea worm or not.
Okay.
So we stay in place for at least 14 months to make sure that there are no other cases showing up. Once we pass that first incubation period, the country can make the claim that it has interrupted transmission. The usual thing that happens afterwards is that the WHO sends a team of international experts to assess the situation and validate or not whether that claim is true or not. And that's how we operate. Beyond that, the country needs to maintain that surveillance nationwide for 3 consecutive years at least.
Okay.
And to make sure, again, that no cases show up. And if the surveillance system is adequate and no cases have been found, then that becomes proof that there was no transmission of guinea worm disease.
Thank you very much. So every time
you have to prove the claim that you have interrupted transmission.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good one to end on. Thank you for all of your questions. Well, turn the stage over to Dr. Hardman again for some closing remarks.
Well, a special thank you to the panelists. They've done an excellent job, and it's been a wonderful, entertaining, and intellectual, stimulating evening. So thank you again, and please join me in sharing that thanks. Well, this concludes our webcast for the evening, and if you're watching us online, I hope that you will share this information with your friends and tell them that you can go to cartercenter.org and watch this program again at the Carter Center website, as well as all of the conversation programs for this season. And keep an eye out at the same website for the 2011-2012 season of Conversations at the Carter Center, and that schedule will be announced very soon. And if you enjoy getting information about the Carter Center and our programs, be sure to stay tuned at the website, but also join our Facebook fan group, as well as following us on Twitter. And I would like to thank all of you, our donors, for participating tonight, and look forward to spending tomorrow with you as we move into our executive briefing, and we will begin sharply at 8 a.m. If you've brought luggage with you, make sure you pick that up at the luggage storage room before proceeding to the shuttle. And as you exit tonight, you will receive a 20-minute copy of the tape, which is the short version of the film, Foul Water, Fiery Serpent. And I hope that you will enjoy watching that and remember what you've seen tonight and share that with friends in your community. So enjoy the rest of the evening. Get to spend time with your friends and new friends that you've met today. And thank you for being with us tonight. Good night.
This has been a podcast from the Carter Center, online at cartercenter.org.